this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Even for Lyndon Johnson, with his outsized Great Society ambitions, the war on poverty was a stretch.
Our aim is not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, to prevent it.
Everything about Johnson had to be larger than life.
This is historian Josh Seitz.
So Johnson delivers his first State of the Union address, and he declares an unconditional war on poverty. Now, this was not a line that was uniformly loved within his White House. There were members of his administration who thought that this was raising expectations wildly beyond what the government was capable of delivering on.
The doubters had a point. Poverty had been a stubborn fact of American life from the earliest days of the Republic. Now, here was a new president, barely 5 weeks in office, vowing to end it for good.
It will not be a short or easy struggle. No single weapon or strategy will suffice. But we shall not rest until that war is won.
Fifty years later, LBJ's declaration of war on poverty remains something of a conundrum. By nearly all accounts, Lyndon Johnson was the canniest political operator of his time. And yet, here he was, in an election year, tying his political fortunes in a very public way to the country's poorest and least powerful citizens. In strictly political terms, poverty was a losing cause and LBJ knew it. So what drew him to this fight? I'm Melody Barnes, and from PRX, this is LBJ and the Great Society.
See if you can get son of a bitch on the phone.
Johnson got votes by pulling lapels.
God damn it, you need to vote with me once in a while, just one time.
And nose to nose.
They beat our mass transit by 30 votes, and we came back and passed that.
I don't think Lyndon, in any sense of the word, was a radical.
Civil rights, we passed that.
He knew more about what made Washington work than anybody.
They had a farm bill beat, we made him pass that.
Just remember, you can tell a man to go to hell, but you can't make him go.
We must and we will go forward.
Episode 2, Mr. Poverty.
Yes?
Dr. Galbraith on 2190.
One of the first people LBJ called for advice on what a war on poverty might look like was the celebrated Harvard economist John Kenneth Galbraith.
Hello, Ken, how are you? I miss you. How are you getting along?
Well, I'm doing very well, but I'm also watching with admiration all of
2 weeks after his State of the Union address, Johnson is already confronting the difficulties of turning his big idea into a viable program.
I saw your speech on this poverty thing. I don't know when you're going to be down this way, but I sure would like to get any ideas you might have as to just the best approach we could make to this thing, because it means so much to the whole country. But you can't run a program like that by committee, as you well know. I would think that what you ought to have is a top-flight, imaginative, young Sergeant Shriver type as the executive director.
I think that's right, and right in the White House.
Probably so.
Johnson is being a little coy here. The truth is, he doesn't want a Sergeant Shriver type. He wants Sergeant Shriver.
Sergeant Shriver is this dynamic, swashbuckling figure straight out of Camelot. Yale-educated World War II combat veteran. He was straight out of the social justice arm of the Catholic Church.
As well as JFK's brother-in-law and the founding head of the Peace Corps.
And the Peace Corps under Shriver drew on the idealism and optimism of that era. It was a real wheelhouse of energy and enthusiasm. And so Johnson calls up Shriver, who's just gotten back from a global tour for the Peace Corps. He's literally just arrived back at his house in Maryland.
I think it was a Saturday, and then my memory serves me right. I was out playing with my children.
In fact, the call is surprising. Shriver's just seen the president the day before.
Customarily, when I went overseas for the Peace Corps, I always came back at the end of the trip and talked to the president and just gave him a personal report. But when it was all over, he said, well, that's very nice. Sarge, thank you very much, and immediately changed the subject. He said, you know, we're getting this war against poverty started. I'd like you to consider running that for us.
This, too, had caught Shriver by surprise.
So I was totally unfamiliar with the whole thing. I had been overseas. All I knew was a little item I read in a Bangkok newspaper that Johnson had indicated that he was going to have a war against poverty. And consequently, I didn't think about it very much.
Uncharacteristically, he'd missed the signal. In the newly declared war on poverty, Sergeant Shriver was about to be the first recruit.
Sarge, good morning, Mr. President. How are you?
I'm going to announce your appointment at press conference.
What press conference?
This afternoon.
The pause here is Shriver picking himself up off the floor.
Well, God, I think it would be advisable, if you don't mind, if I could have this weekend, I wanted to sit down with a couple of people.
Johnson came in and said, run this war against poverty. Well, I mean, it's a joke in a way, but I didn't know a damn thing about poverty, and I told him so. And I didn't want the job.
Could you just say that you've asked me to study this?
No, hell no. They've studied and studied and studied. They want to know who in the hell's going to do this, and they'll be shooting me with questions. They already done it.
Shriver was a good soldier, confident, ambitious, and deeply committed to public service. But this appears to be one job he really didn't want.
I was home for the first time in months, and I was working at the Peace Corps, and when I'd go home at night, my business was to get back into a pattern of living with my family and with the new reality that Jack Kennedy was dead. I mean, you know, he'd only been killed 60 days before.
All good reasons to say no, but not nearly good enough for Johnson.
I was screaming my buddy head off that I shouldn't do it. He didn't want me to give up the Peace Corps. He wanted me to run both of them.
It's not going to be anything but a compliment to you. I'm just giving you $1 billion more to work with. If you can't run a $100 million program in your left hand and a billion with your right hand, you're not as smart as I think you are. But I am going to make it clear that you're Mr. Poverty, at home and abroad, if you want to be.
Well,
you got the responsibilities, you got the authority, you got the power, you got the money. Now, you may not have the glands.
The glands?
Yeah.
I got plenty of glands.
All right.
And so it goes for 20 minutes. Shriver desperately looking for cover, Johnson in relentless pursuit. In the end, there's no place to hide.
I don't know of anybody who can really stand up against Lyndon Johnson.
Harry McPherson was a longtime Johnson aide and speechwriter.
Nobody has his resources as a debater in private. He is overpowering. He has 50 reasons why he wants to do something, and you may have 2 reasons why you don't. Maybe you knock off 10 of his with your 2, but he's still got 40 left. But mostly it is the superior exercise of brain. I really believe it. He is tougher and smarter than anybody I ever saw.
Anybody, including, finally, Sergeant Shriver. 3 hours after the White House operators first tracked him down, it's a done deal.
I have asked Sergeant Shriver to serve as special assistant to the president in the organization of the War on Poverty program, which I announced in my State of the Union message.
So Johnson has carried the day, but he sensed that his strong-arm tactics have left a few bruises, so he calls again to repair the damage.
Sarge?
Yeah?
I couldn't talk to you freely.
Oh, excuse me.
This is Lyndon Johnson.
Yes, sir. Sure.
Now, I don't want to make you feel bad because you're too successful, and I'm too proud of you to ever pour cold water on it. But up to 1 minute before I appeared, I was meeting violent protest to naming you. Now, I couldn't let that grow and continue.
Yeah.
I've had other folks recommended and other people pressed, and I just had to ride roughshod over them. But I couldn't tell you that when some of them were sitting there.
Even as Johnson is buttering up his new recruit, he's also sending a different message. You're lucky to get this job.
Well, some of the people who were protesting were right there.
Well, some of the people that just, 1 minute before you called me, one of them saying, this just can't go with my little announcement. And I was talking in their presence.
I see.
So now don't go trying to figure out who it is, because it's nothing to worry about. It's done. The decision's made. The water's behind us. Now you get to do whatever you need to do, and I'll support you all the way to the hilt. Yes, and this is the best thing this administration's done. But they'll defeat it and kill it if we let them do it. Now come on and let's do it. And we're going to have a lot of hell and a lot of problems. But you're going to do this all right. And if it can be done, we'll make a hero out of you for failing. That's the kind of team we play on.
This is a different side of Lyndon Johnson, one he seldom showed in public.
Lyndon Johnson, as we all know, is as self-centered a man as ever was. But he has the capacity to empathize with very intimate human problems of people who are of some concern to him, and many who are not. I mean, he can feel when an old woman falls down the street, his shins ache a little. He's a hard-nosed guy, and he's tough as nails, but he has that capacity for empathy that came out in very peculiar ways.
He looks like you got all the headlines.
Well, I'm sure of that.
At 6:30 that same night, with the story now breaking in the evening papers, Johnson checks in yet again, this time just to celebrate.
Popular, personable businessman. Give me some of that stuff they've been writing about Shriver over there, Jack, right quick. Sergeant Shriver, director of the Peace Corps, become a special assistant to President Johnson to direct this administration's campaign against poverty. Johnson described Shriver as eminently qualified and said the Peace Corps director, brother-in-law of the late president, was outstanding qualities of leadership. God almighty, I wish I could buy that kind of advertisement.
The president's having a little fun here. Through the first 2 years of his term, his own approval ratings will seldom dip below 65%. But the victory lap is brief.
Now, what you do is you've got to get together and see how in the hell you're going to administer this thing. Then you're going to have to get that bill and that message together. Then you're going to have to get up to that Congress and walk it through.
Yeah.
And see that every damn thing that can be done for poverty is done.
Yeah.
You'll have more influence in this administration than any man in it. And you'll have $1 billion to pass out. So you just call up the Pope and tell him you may not be at church every morning on time, but you're going to be working for the good of humanity.
Yeah.
Sky's the limit. You just make this thing work, period. And we don't give a damn about the details.
Just make this thing work, Johnson says, and don't give a damn about the details. In other words, move and move fast. Johnson wanted a bill he could send to Congress by mid-March. That left Shriver just 6 weeks to turn LBJ's big idea into legislation that could get past the Congress. Now it fell to Shriver to make it happen. More after this quick break.
Hi, I'm David Brown, host of the Texas Standard on Public Radio. If you're enjoying this series, let me tell you about another big piece of the LBJ story which I had a hand in and one you'll almost certainly find fascinating. It's LBJ's War, a sister series to the one you're listening to right now. It's the story of a president bound for greatness and the ruinous war where he lost his way. Check out LBJ's War right where you found this podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. That's LBJ's War. Now, back to LBJ and the Great Society.
The practical problem was this. How do you get rid of poverty? That's the question. The answer is nobody knows now or knew then exactly how to do that. The immediate reaction, if you ask 10 people, how do you go about eliminating poverty, is you get 10 different answers. Some people were devotees of giving people jobs, or others providing with them an education, or others saying it was all a question of health, or another one saying it was all a question of whether they could speak English or not. So for a war, a total comprehensive effort to be waged required a variety of different initiatives. Nobody was able to say at the start which would or would not produce results.
Shriver's first task was to assemble a team.
Whenever I was confronted with trying to run something that I didn't know anything about, which this is a good example of, I would go out and get the smartest people I could find that could help us. And so I went and I got the guys I always got.
And at about 3 or 4 o'clock that afternoon, it was a Sunday, and I got a call from Sergeant Secretary, who said to me, would I come to a meeting at Shriver's office in the Peace Corps at 6 o'clock?
Frank Mankiewicz worked for the Peace Corps in Peru, but happened to be in Washington that week.
I said, sure. What's it about? She said, well, it's about this poverty war. So I went.
And so did a lot of other people, all of them mobilized by Shriver with the same zeal and urgency that Johnson had brought to bear on him.
Johnson had a lot of faith in the public sector. He believed, based on his New Deal experience, that government could be a force for good, and recognized that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of very talented experts who were stuffed inside all of the old New Deal bureaucratic offices throughout D.C. Unlike John Kennedy, who actually had very little regard for the bureaucracy, Johnson knew that inside, you know, those agencies were experts on all manner of things. And so he drew them into his government in a way that kind of breathed a new life into what was before that a kind of moribund federal bureaucracy.
At a series of meetings over the next few weeks, Shriver made roughly the same pitch that he'd made 2 years before when he launched the Peace Corps.
I said, look, here's the problem. We're supposed to organize a war against poverty. What do you think we ought to do? The analogy between the Peace Corps and the war against poverty is striking, to me at least, because by way of instructions, we had maybe three sentences in a speech that Kennedy had given. That was it. And the war on poverty was similarly grandiose, but unspecific. We're going to have a war to eliminate, to eradicate poverty. Well, I mean, who knew what that was?
The answer was nobody. But Shriver and his boss were undaunted.
This was a very optimistic time. Americans truly felt that the country that had lifted itself and the world out of the Great Depression, defeated fascism on two continents, created this booming post-war economy, defeated polio, was sending rockets up into space. It could do anything. And so when Johnson says, I'm declaring an unconditional war on poverty, that didn't necessarily strike people as disingenuous at the time.
We were a generation of people who had been in World War II. So when a war against poverty was launched, it was typical of all of us at that time to think of this war, the war against poverty, in terms just like the war against Hitler. We were accustomed to thinking in terms of the United States being able to do big things. America bestrode the world like a colossus. There was nothing in the world equal to the United States of America.
Shriver's invitation to think big opened the floodgates.
And we began writing a series of memoranda to Shriver on some ideas that we had all sort of come up with about what kinds of things ought to be included in a poverty program.
The basic idea of this whole operation was simply to pick the brains of any qualified and many unqualified Americans, of asking them what they would do if they had the job of trying to run a war against poverty. So what we did was we said, well, let's get in a half a dozen economists. And then we did the same thing with businessmen, and we did the same thing with labor leaders. And we did the same thing with women, et cetera. We were trying to extract ideas out of America for what to do.
Inevitably, some ideas were better than others.
I remember we got an awful lot of industrialists to come in. I remember particularly going to lunch with the president of the Chrysler Corporation, whose major contribution to the war on poverty, and the only one he really suggested, we thought the whole thing could be solved if only the cost of domestic servants could be made tax deductible. Felt that this would open up wide avenues of employment for Negro women and provide a great boost to the middle class. And he talked at length about how his wife was unable to get servants. It was a rather disappointing luncheon.
It was extraordinarily chaotic, and I never knew what to expect.
Robert Lampman taught economics at the University of Wisconsin. He had just returned to Madison from a stint in D.C. when he was summoned back as a consultant.
There was some organization, I guess, but it seemed more like the organization in a lobby of a big hotel or something to me, where you just wander around from one corner of the big room to another, and various things would be going on, and you could listen in or raise your hand and say something. And there were various pieces of paper that would float by, and then you could comment on it. I never knew quite to whom I was reporting, but I would get requests for things like, tell us about the special problems of poverty in West Virginia or something like that.
So Shriver is running the Peace Corps by day and building the war on poverty by night and on weekends. They're meeting in borrowed office space all over Washington, D.C. It was moving from building to building because there was no permanent space for them. At one point, they ended up working in a building where the ceiling collapsed and they had to, you know, change quarters overnight. So it was always difficult to know how to get a hold of somebody.
And through all of this period, Shriver were perfectly willing to let us do anything, come up with all kinds of suggestions, and these would all go into a pot. It was rather informal. We spent a lot of time at Shriver's house. We would stay up late because it was the best time to get work done because there were no phones ringing.
And so, you know, his house in the coming weeks became, you know, a virtual nonstop seminar for economists and social workers and doctors. And he had this knack for gathering around him the brilliant, the quirky, the eccentric. And so Shriver would hold these marathon days every Saturday, every Sunday at his estate in Maryland, where all of these staff members would bring their family members. The kids would be out on the lawn playing touch football, swimming in the pool. And the adults were hashing out, you know, the war on poverty in his living room.
As Shriver and his task force scrambled to put a bill together, the president worked to insulate their efforts from pressure, some from inside his own shop. Here he is, running interference with Orville Freeman, his Secretary of Agriculture.
You're not clipping Shriver any of these news leaks. You're going along with him, aren't you, in agriculture?
Oh, yes.
Well, somebody's clipping him. I can't catch whoever's doing it, HEW or Labor, because every damn day I haven't even got the message yet. They're leaking and they're raising hell. He's the only guy that's ever going to get us any poverty through up there, and we got to stop the jealousy in these departments. And I want you to put your foot down and say, I'm willing to yield and sacrifice. Yeah, and we can't all be captains. Let's put them all together and let him be the front till we get our money.
Well, I agree with you 1,000%. Are you going to put him in your office in administering this?
Yes, sir.
That's
yes,
where
sir.
He belongs. I think
that's where he belongs. But you just please, they all gutting me and cutting me and leaking it. But you could set a good example, but just say, now let's quit this bellyache and gripe and quit feeding it to paper. It just benefits Republicans.
Johnson's decision to house the fledgling program in the White House, rather than with existing departments, was a measure of his determination to see the program succeed, no matter what the political cost.
Lyndon Johnson knew more about what made Washington work and didn't work than anybody. And he knew that if you put something like the war against poverty into an existing bureaucracy, you killed it. He believed that the war against poverty was going to be subjected to a huge amount of criticism, and that putting it in the executive office of the president, making it his program, the president's program, would minimize attacks from congressmen because, and he told me this, they would believe that they were in fact attacking Johnson. So he put it right next to him in order to protect it.
Johnson was right to worry. The war on poverty would ultimately draw more fire than almost any other Great Society program.
He may have at times underestimated the backlash that would come his way, but he certainly did appreciate the fact that he was making a conscious decision to spend valuable political capital down on something that was going to be very risky. What's impressive about Johnson is that he knew it, and he did it, and he had no regrets about doing it.
He was a complicated human being, but one of the great dominating ideas of his life was to help people. He had that motivation, Johnson did, from his earliest manhood, to do something about those people who were not getting, you might say, a fair shake. And as president of the United States, he wanted to help them as only a president can help them, by using the engine of government, using the resources of government to help people who were unfortunate. So I think that's how he saw it.
By mid-March, right on schedule, the Shriver Task Force had a bill for the president to take to the Hill. It was vague on specifics, but its vast scope and ambition would not be lost on Congress. Getting it through would test the limits of Johnson's skill and resolve.
This is like being up in a parachute jump. You only get one chance. You jump and the chute opens or it doesn't open. And with the war against poverty, the chute had to open up the first time. We weren't going to get a second chance.
In our next episode, LBJ takes his crusade to Congress and the country.
Can you help us free these Americans from the prison of poverty? And if you can, let me hear your voices.
I'm Melody Barnes. This episode was written by Steve Atlas, the executive producer. Senior producer Derek John did the sound design. Caitlin Rathy is our producer and researcher. Additional research from Julia Chen. Creative consultant Paul Taylor. Special thanks to the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas, to Rotunda, the digital imprint of the University of Virginia Press, for use of the presidential recordings, and to the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. And special thanks also to Michael Gillette, author of Launching the War on Poverty and Oral History. For more on the series, visit lbjsgreatsociety.org. That's lbjsgreatsociety.org. Or find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the series. Major funding for this project has been provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.